I think my favourite of the animals we went to see was the kakapo, which is a... Oh, some kakapo fans in the audience. The kakapo is the world's largest, fattest, and least able to fly parrot. Lives in New Zealand. It has, as I say, forgotten how to fly. Sadly, it has also forgotten that it's forgotten how to fly. So a seriously worried kakapo will occasionally run up a tree and jump out of it. Opinion divides as to what then happens. Some people will tell you that the kakapo has some sort of rudimentary parachuting ability. Other people will tell you that it flies like a brick. But the point is that kakapos very rarely get seriously worried because of where they grew up, which is they grew up on New Zealand. Now, New Zealand is a very interesting country in that it was not, as I say, part of Australasia. It wasn't part of Gondwanaland. It was just this load of gunk that came up from out of the ocean, with the result that it had no life on it. Other than a few dead fishes, I suppose, but it had... So the only life that got to New Zealand was the life that could fly there, i.e. birds. So New Zealand was entirely populated by birds, other than a couple of species of bats, which are mammals, as you'll know, but the principle holds good. You had to fly there to get there. With the result that the ecology of New Zealand was sort of slightly unbalanced, and there was nothing living on the ground. And there were no predators on New Zealand. Now, growing up in an environment with no predators is something that is almost hard for us to imagine, because we are used to dealing with the world kind of warily. You know, you meet somebody new, you size them up before you know how you're going to be involved with them. We tend to be suspicious, wary, cautious creatures by nature. You'll size up a situation before you get involved in it, and that's because we grew up. Like most animals on this planet, we evolved through in environments that had predators in them, so we all had to be wary and cautious, and those of us who weren't didn't survive. Now, New Zealand, there were no predators, so nobody ever learned to worry. Now, actually, the most extreme example of this I know is actually not in New Zealand, but is on the Galapagos Islands, where there is a bird called the blue-footed booby, and it's called the blue-footed booby, I'm convinced, for two reasons. One of which has to do with the colour of its feet. And the reason it's called a booby, I'm convinced, has to do with this small piece of behaviour. Because you can walk up to a blue-footed booby that's sitting there on the ground or on a branch. You can walk up to it and you can pick it up. Because what the booby will be thinking, and this is why we call it a booby, I think, is that once we finish with it, we'll put it back. It doesn't know any different. And the same was true in New Zealand. Because there were no predators, none of the animals developed any of the things that we think of as normal, natural pieces of behaviour, which is wariness and caution and a tendency to run like hell. And because one of the functions of flying is that it's an escape mechanism, it's a way you escape something that wants to come and attack you or eat you. And because there was nothing on New Zealand that wanted to eat you particularly, and because flying is also a rather expensive form of travel, now I'm not talking about the airline cartels, I'm talking about the fact that it takes a lot of energy to fly. You have to, you know, beating your wings and keeping yourself aloft takes a lot of energy. And you take energy in the form of food. And the more you eat, the heavier you get, and the more difficult it is to fly. So you have to eat a bit, fly a bit, eat a bit, fly a bit. It's actually rather a complicated and stressful form of life. And so, because there were no predators on New Zealand, and nobody was kind of living on the ground, and life always kind of flows into available niches, so a number of the animals, if I can be rather naughty and anthropomorphize at the moment, a number of the birds, kind of, it's almost as if they sat down and thought, well, actually, what we can sit down and have a rather larger meal and just go for a waddle afterwards. So eventually, a number of the birds, like the kakapo and the kiwi, which of course is a symbol of New Zealand, the weka and one or two other birds, eventually lost the ability to fly. They evolved into ground-living animals. So of course, when man finally arrives on New Zealand, bringing with him his dangerous, deadly menagerie of dogs and cats and stoats and rabbits, and that most of predatory of all animals, Rattus rattus, the ship's rat, which goes with man everywhere, suddenly the birds were waddling for their lives, those that knew to do it. But mostly they didn't know to do it. So the kakapo, if confronted with a stoat or something that wants to eat it, simply doesn't know the form. It hasn't been introduced properly by evolutionary processes. So he just kind of sits there and waits for the other animal to make the first move, which is usually just to kill it. So as a result of this, since man arrived on New Zealand, the population of the kakapo has dropped from, we're not quite certain what it originally was, but somewhere up in hundreds of thousands or maybe millions of kakapo, has now dropped to a figure that the last I heard was about 45. And there is a desperate struggle to try and keep these animals alive because they are completely helpless in the face of anything that might want to attack it. So what are the animals themselves doing to help themselves in this evolutionary crisis they've suddenly arrived at? Well, not a lot, because we have this problem with the kakapo, which is the way in which they reproduce. The mating rituals of the kakapo are incredibly long drawn out, fantastically complicated, and almost totally ineffective. Some people will tell you that the mating call of the male kakapo actively repels the female kakapo, which is the sort of behaviour you otherwise only find in discotheques. What the male kakapo does when it comes to mating season is he finds himself a rocky promontory overlooking some vast, wonderful valley, because acoustics are very important to what it's about to do. And it hollows out this bowl in the ground on this rocky promontory, and it sits in it, and it puffs out these two enormous air sacs around its chest, which is going to be reverberation chambers. And it sits there night after night for about 100 nights of the year. For eight, and it performs over and over again. For 100 nights of the year, for 8 hours a night, it performs over and over again the opening bars of Dark Side of the Moon. Now, those... Now, those of you who remember all the way back to the 70s, will remember the Dark Side of the Moon starts with this great, deep, thumping heartbeat. And this is the noise the kakapo makes. It's so deep and so reverberant that, in fact, human ears can only just pick it up. I mean, some people will tell you you can't quite hear it to begin with. You more feel it like a reverberation in the pit of your stomach. And then gradually your ear tunes into it and you hear this great whoomp, whoomp, whoomp heartbeat echoing around the valleys of New Zealand. Now, there are two things you need to know about bass sound. Bass sound has two characteristics, two important characteristics, one of which is it carries vast distances. The long, slow, big wavelengths fill the valleys. So that, because there are very few kakapo left, so you've got some are going to sort of reach the female kakapo who may be out there. But if there are any female kakapo out there, and if they like the sound of this booming, which they probably don't, We then reach a problem caused by the second characteristic of bass sound, which is, well, let me see if I can illustrate this. Do you know there's sort of there's a particular kind of stereo speakers you can get, where you have two tiny little speakers that you have to place very carefully in the room because they're carrying all the treble information and they give you your stereo image. And then you have some big bass box called a woofer that you can put anywhere in the room you like. You can put it behind the sofa if you like, because the second characteristic of bass sound, and remember this is the mating call of the male kakapo we're talking about, is that you can't tell where it's coming from. So just imagine, supposing there are some female kakapos out there, which there probably aren't, and supposing they like the sound of this booming, which they probably don't, supposing that they can then find where it's coming from, which they probably can't, if they overcome all those obstacles and actually find the male kakapo, the female kakapo will then only consent to mate if the podocarp tree is in fruit. Now, we will... We've all had relationships like that. Supposing you got through all these obstacles and actually succeed in mating, the female kakapo will then lay one single egg every 2 years, which promptly gets eaten by a stoat or a rat. And you think, how the hell has this stupid creature lasted this long? I mean, let alone the other problems it's now got, how the hell has it lasted this long if it reproduces in this stupid way? And the answer is a very interesting one, which is, it survived this long precisely because of that strategy. Now that seems peculiar to us. That seems very, very odd to us. The reason it seems odd to us is because we grew up, and I'm talking about growing up in evolutionary terms, we evolved in a world which was full of predators, and the kakapo didn't. Now, if you reproduce too fast within any given environmental set of circumstances, then you can easily outstrip your environment's ability to sustain your population at any given level, and your population can plummet because it's got too big too quickly. And if you're living in a world where you're not being culled by anything, in which there's no predator coming along to eat you, then your reproductive rate, if it's going to be successful, is going to be much, much slower. So making such a song and dance out of their reproductive techniques is exactly what enabled them to reach a good, stable situation, the population, until the point in which human beings came along and mucked it all up. Now, because we come carrying our own mindset, our own idea of what the world looks like, our own idea of how the world works, we look at this animal and think it's stupid. Why is it doing this stupid stuff when it's not helping it any, when it's actually being counterproductive in terms of how it's living its life? But you see, the thing is that because the kakapo evolved that way, it's the only way it knows how to behave. To do anything else, to revise its reproductive strategy, would be against kakapo nature. It would be a kind of in-kakapo thing to do. But meanwhile, of course, the monkeys, the monkeys' descendants, i.e. us, we have evolved our own strategy, which has been very, very successful up to this point, which is taking the world for all it's got, competing like crazy with each other, and we have thereby become extremely successful and have thrived on this planet and filled it. But as a result of that happening, the nature of the world we live in has now changed, just as the nature of the world that the kakapo lives in has now changed. And Whereas the kakapo, if I can be naughty and anthropomorphize again, finding itself in this desperate situation of its population just plummeting, is thinking, well, what do we do well? We reproduce very slowly, so let's give that a try. And of course, the population plummets still further. So they think, well, let's reproduce really slowly. And you see the problem. But in the end, you see, we are doing precisely the same thing, because the things that have been good strategies for us, which is taking whatever we need from the planet without any thought for what the consequences of that might be, because when that strategy evolved, the world compared to the size of the world and the size of the world's resources compared to the size of our population meant that the world was indistinguishable from being infinitely big. But it isn't anymore, but we continue to carry out the same strategies, because to do anything else would be against human nature, would be an inhuman thing to do. So it seems to me that we get fantastically useful and helpful sort of parables from looking at the animal world to seeing something, to understanding the way in which we work on this planet.